Thanks very much, everybody, for coming. It's great to see we have such a packed room. And I realize we should have booked a larger space, probably. So my name is Andrew Kirk. I'm chair of the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering here at McGill. And on behalf of the Faculty of Engineering and also of the Truckee Institute of Sustainability in Engineering and Design, which is directed by Professor Sebastian Gershaw over here, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Christina Johnson. So I first knew Christina, I guess, back in the early 1990s when I was a postdoc researcher looking for another postdoc position, and Christina was a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and she was doing some fantastic research in smart pixels and crystal devices, and I really wanted to work there. Handed her probably for unmercifully for a while, but anyway, I ended up here at McGill, and so the rest is history.
That's great.
And I didn't do so badly, I don't think. So, but anyway, that's not about me, it's about Christina. So, Dr. Johnson is a graduate of Stanford University in Electrical Engineering. And what amazes me is the breadth of what she's done. She's held, she did a lot of work as a professor, sort of at the lab bench. She holds 129 U.S. and international patents. She's written many, many academic papers. And then she went on, that wasn't enough, then she went on to become Dean of Engineering at Duke. And then she went on to become Provost and Senior Vice President at Johns Hopkins. And then, that wasn't enough, so then she went to work in government for a while. She was Undersecretary of Energy for the U.S. under Barack Obama, spearheading a aggressive national plan to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions and promote clean energy. She was responsible for managing a $10.5 billion energy and environment portfolio and played an important role to develop an integrated strategic technologies energy plan for reducing U.S. dependence on imported oil by 75%, achieving greenhouse gas reductions of 83% by 2050, and achieving 80% low carbon electricity by 2035. So I just have to come back in 20 years to see how that's working out.
Yeah.
But since then, that wasn't enough. So since then, she is now CEO and founding partner of Enduring Hydro, which is a company that invests in, develops and modernizes hydroelectric facilities and provides consulting services on regulatory, permit and tax incentive programs related to hydroelectric power projects. And Dr. Johnson has received numerous recognitions for contributions to the field, including the John Fritz Medal, which is considered the highest award given to engineering professor, and previous winners include Marconi and Gordon Moore, so she's in very good company. She's also an NSF Presidential Investigator winner, Fulbright Scholar. She received the Dennis Gabor Prize, Society of Women Engineers Lifetime Achievement Awards, and many, many others. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Christina Johnson to talk to us today.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Andrew, Chairperson Kirk. I can see that not hiring you back then, you went on to do great things. So if I can help anybody else with their career, just I'm ready. Right now, I just want to set the stage a little bit. I'm thrilled to be here for so many reasons. But one is we're talking about clean energy right before the talk. And to realize that 90% of your electricity is hydropower, I mean, I just feel so good. In America, we would never have a hydropower plant in this picture. You know, you'd have solar and you'd have wind, but you wouldn't have hydro. And I think that's unfortunate because, as I say in some talks, I think hydropower in the U.S. is the first renewable, the original renewable, the forgotten renewable, and I could go on. Just a little bit of history about why hydropower. You know, I think it was a combination of a few things. We had a little downturn in the economy. You may have read about in about 2009, maybe experienced some of it. And that led to a stimulus program where we had $37 billion in clean energy funding to try and, with the goal, double the amount of renewables in the U.S. I'm going to talk about what we were able to do over those 2 years. There was nothing in it for hydropower, zero. So, you know, it's congressionally mandated, and you have to go through and look at the legislation and find out what can be justified. So I found an area where we could justify a $30 million solicitation in hydro. We had 77 proposals of shovel-ready projects. Now, we can only fund 7. So we did at least do that, and I just became really fascinated with hydro to the extent where, when I got out, decided to start this company. I do come by it, and there's a Canadian connection with hydropower in my family. My grandfather's first job was in hydropower in Canada, and he was recruited back by George Westinghouse to actually go join him. And at the time of his death in 1920, he was head of engineering, reporting directly to Mr. Westinghouse and the company. He died when my father was only five. So I think that's why he became an electrical engineer, is to try and find out, you know, what his father loved about it. My father regrettably passed when I was a later teenager, was in second year in university, so that's why I declared to become an electrical engineer, so I could find out what. So it's the third generation of this, and here we are with hydropower. So there are times when I visit plants in the U.S. I haven't yet visited a plant up in Canada, but I can imagine their fingerprints on a lot of the equipment, and believe me, it is that old. So we have a lot we can do in the U.S. But let's start back a little bit by... And I do want to have a bit of a conversation, since we're a small, intimate group, notwithstanding those standing, and to have a few Q&A. So I'm going to watch the clock, and if I accelerate a little bit and skip some things, we can come back. But I do want to gain your knowledge, because I'm thrilled to be here at the, I believe it's pronounced TISED, Institute, and thank you for this opportunity. So I start usually a talk, because I never know quite what the audience is. If there's, you know, climate change folks who believe that humans have a role to play in climate change or not. So this is a series of photographs. I'm going to flip through them, and I hope that they come in with the animation of a park that it borders our two countries, Glacier National Park, you know, out west. So this was taken, maybe 60, I'm trying to think if I can, yeah. So this is sort of a progression, and I may have already gone through the progression, but this was probably taken less than 10 years ago. So the original one was 60 or 70 years ago when this park was founded and recently celebrated its 100th anniversary of being discovered or rediscovered, if you will, by Grinnell, and this is Grinnell Glacier. Since then, over 50% of the glaciers in Glacier National Park over the last 100 years have disappeared. And they expect, unfortunately, over the next 10 years, the rest will disappear. And owing to some of the changes in temperature, not getting cold enough, et cetera. So let me go forward, if I've done this right. You can see that over the 60 years of these photographs, we really have lost a lot of it. So came into the administration, worked directly for Secretary Stephen Chu, who is a very big proponent of taking care of the environment and also clean energy. And the Obama administration, the president had an aspirational goal. Can we cut CO2 emissions 80% from 2005 levels by 2050? So as an engineer, I decided to take a really big problem, and this is a really big problem, and I believe I do have a pointer here. I can go through this. So the U.S. right now produces roughly 5.5 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. And this data point here is 2010, goes out to 2050. So we're trying to go from 5.5 down by 80%, we'd be about 1.8 gigatons. And in terms of petroleum use, in order to do that, we'd have to, over here, we'd have to tremendously cut our petroleum use and really only use it for higher and better uses where we can't use it for, where we don't have a fuel switching option. So when we look at this and we look at how would we have to change our electrical generation here, our transportation sector, our emissions due to industry and then to buildings, you can see that there's some pretty sharp decreases here that we would have to come up with. So, you know, if you're an engineer, one of the things we learn about engineering is that engineers are all about design under constraint. And this first constraint I want to point out is the 40 years, and the reason for 40 years is that, you know, the temperature is increasing. We are already cruising close, if we haven't already exceeded 400 parts per million carbon in the atmosphere. That you know, somewhere out here, closer to 20, 30, 40, or 50, we may start to see, and maybe we are also now seeing irreversible events. So the question is, the first time is, how quickly can we change our energy use over 40 years? And so that's one of the first things we looked at. Second thing is, what do engineers do? We take a really big problem and break it down into smaller pieces. So trying to figure out, if we want to get to 80% by 2050, what does that mean in 2030? What does that mean in 2020? What does that mean in 2040? And some of the decisions we might make in 2010 and 2020 may actually commit us to certain infrastructure investments that won't be depreciated in time so that we would actually make that change. So walking through, you know, people often ask me, do you think it's too late? I don't think it's too late, but it's not too early either, right? So we set out to do a strategic technology energy plan as the first step, if you will, along this path. And the goal of this was to say, really put some meat on the bones of the Obama all the above strategy. You know, you hear this a lot. We actually wrote about a 150-page document. We had over 100 Department of Energy researchers working on this. So we do have a lot of data and a lot of information to back it up. So it's going to be a portfolio approach. We're not going to say we can do it all with renewables or all with nuclear or all with carbon capture and sequestration or all with hydropower, regrettably. But we want to use known technologies, so nothing risky, no miracles, no Hail Marys, as they would say, and try and take a very long-term view. You know, what needs to happen in 10, 20, 30, 40 years? And it also doesn't, our analysis, which is to say, how do we reach this aspirational goal, doesn't involve any cap-and-trade offsets, nor what I would call carbon sink effects. So we're not talking, we didn't include anything like tree planting or any other sorts of strategies that may have an effect. They're just, they're bonus, and kind of that's where we left it. So what is it within the scope is we're looking for one path, a portfolio approach, and trying to look at what would it take in terms of direct capital operating and fuel expense between 2010 and 2050 to reduce our carbon footprint. And it's all calculated on what it would be a societal basis, so it wasn't broken down in geographies, but we're starting to do that now. I mean, as was pointed out in our conversation earlier, you know, I suspect that Quebec has quite a smaller footprint because your 90% of your electricity is, from what I understand, is from hydropower. So when you think of all the different uses, you know, our first lever here, as you'll see in a minute, is in the U.S. we've got to decarbonize the electric sector because over 60%, almost two-thirds, is either natural gas or coal. And so we have to reduce that to under 20%. So we'll get to that in a few minutes. What isn't included, and this is quite interesting, some of the studies, you know, clearly how do you quantify national security? You know, you could look at what we expended on some wars. You know, that would be maybe one thing to look at. Domestic job creation and global trade has an impact. And the impact on health, there was a brilliant researcher at Harvard, you may have read some of the papers, Paul Epstein, who wrote about, you know, the impact of a coal-based electrical sector on our health. And it said if you took into account the cases from emphysema, lung disease, et cetera, you would actually end up paying three times the cost for the electricity from coal-fired, which would be about 30 cents per kilowatt hour. It's roughly 10 to 11 cents per kilowatt hour in the U.S. right now. So those are not taken into account in terms of the cost of trying to achieve this goal. So after studying this and you know, researchers from nuclear energy, from the fossil fuel energy assistant secretary, from renewable energy and energy efficiency, and even waste, we said there are really five things, at least from the U.S. perspective, and I'm going to comment a little bit about how I see it, but I'd like to become much more educated. How do we translate this into a Canadian perspective? But we in the U.S. need to definitely decarbonize our electric sector. If we can decarbonize the electric sector, then what we want to do is electrify light-duty vehicles. Even electrifying, often individuals will say things like, well, gee, if we use electric vehicles, what's the difference? You know, the electricity is still from fossil fuel. And, you know, and then say, well, you know, you get a third benefit. But it'd be nice to get two-thirds to 80% benefit. Now, if we look at a 50% penetration by 2035, some people will say, do you know how long it took for there to be a million Priuses purchased in the U.S.? By the way, there's something like roughly 300 million, 330 million individuals. I forget, how many cars are there? I know there's 240 million gallons used per day. So I think there's like roughly the average of two cars per two or three people. So hundreds of millions of cars. It took a decade to penetrate just 1 million Priuses in the U.S. And so people throw that at me and I say, well, yes, that's fine. But let's look at another way of looking at it. During a really robust economy, the U.S. buys 15 million cars per year. And at least European automotive manufacturers say that by 2020, every single new model will be either an electric vehicle or a hybrid. And so if you go from 2020 to 2035, 15 years, 15 million a year, hopefully, knock on wood, is a good economy, you've penetrated 50% of the vehicles will be at least a hybrid or electric vehicle. So I'm pretty bullish on that. I think we can do that. It's not an outrageous thing to think about. In terms of energy efficiency and conservation, this is probably the biggest one, because business as usual, we, in the U.S., it's about 100 quads of energy we use per year. And we would have to stick that number so that out of 2050, we're still just using 100 quads, which means that the rate, and we do have a certain set of assumptions on gross domestic product increase, population increase, and just in certain growth in industry, we'd have to reduce our consumption of energy by 23 quads, or roughly 25 to 30% out at 2050. The last thing is that I mentioned a little bit about visiting a lot of the hydropower plants in the U.S. and seeing that many of them still have a lot of the old analog equipment. I mean, these things were built, and I know you probably all know this, but it's amazing with slide rules and bringing up equipment on the backs of donkeys, and the forms for the powerhouse were formed with, you know, wooden planks that you can still see the grain of the wood. I mean, that was real engineering. But we haven't done much with it since then. So we do need to modernize the transmission and distribution. I'm going to show some curves about what the effect of that would be. And then finally, for heavy-duty freight, we need to off-freight freight in air transportation to either, and we have to do the analysis carefully, but on train or on heavy-duty vehicles that are also do fuel switching to a biofuel away from. So those are the five things that we need to look on, or work on, and then we developed the budget for the next 5 years based on supporting these particular priorities. Now, I mentioned before that engineering is about design under a constraint, and one of the constraints is time. And the reason for that is if we look at the full width half maximum of wood, how many years did we use wood? Well, it's, you know, from like the invention of fire all the way up to somewhere around, you know, the first turn of the last century, we had wood as the majority fuel source. And then we went through about another 60 to 80 years where we're coal, and then we've gone through oil. The challenge here is that if we're really going to get this done in 40 years, we can't rely on any one particular technology. We're going to need them all. And I think that's more of a technical, historical view of why the all-above strategy is the one that we've adopted. What's really interesting is that a lot of individuals in Silicon Valley, venture capitalists, funded tens of companies, if not in a portfolio of 50 companies each. And really, when I think about this, it's not a venture capital play. It's not something where you're going to get a return in 5 to 7 years and flip it, for example, or take it public. And so I just looked at what is, you know, this is, Silicon Valley has been extraordinarily successful in terms of the IT revolution. And what we're plotting here is we're looking at how fast did it take to switch the use of memory to flash memory, from CDs, from mag tape, 4 years. I mean, if you look at this here, if we look at the flash MP3, MP4, you don't see hardly, you know, certainly less than 25%. And by 2008, within 4 years, it was the majority medium for memory. So this is not an IT play. And I think that took a while for the market to really understand. So this is sort of a takeoff on the, you know, the waterfall sector analysis, but it really shows that 31% of our reduction in energy has to come from either energy efficiency or from conservation. Now, there's you may have read papers about very interesting papers about the rebound effect, right? So I think that the rebound effect is important when it comes to, let me digress and tell a little story for a minute. If you were on my holiday list for the last, I don't know, 5 years, what you got was a sack of CFLs or LEDs, you know, recyclable bins. I mean, I you know, you really didn't want to be on my list. But now when I think about that, how far we've come in that period of time, that most everybody I know already had those things. So, you know, I'm trying to make this impact and do this energy efficiency, so I go and have the holidays with my sisters who are here, going to be with us tomorrow, and they all have their CFLs from past years. And I go, well, but you're leaving the lights on. Oh, but that's okay because they save more energy, right? So I can leave them on all night. And I went, no, let's talk about this, but maybe after the holidays because it's kind of tense anyway sometimes. Never at our house, of course, but anyhow. Yes, yeah, so this rebound effect I think happens when the incremental cost of the widget, if you can have one, you can have two. So refrigerators, appliances, you see that. You know, you might have two refrigerators when the cost and the efficiency went down so much that then people bought two and then they used twice the energy. But think about where investments in energy and in conservation would not impact, would not be impacted by the rebound effect. And I think buildings, right? You buy a house. We found in the Recovery Act we spent order of $5 billion on weatherization of homes. When you weatherize a home, at least in the U.S., the sweet spot's about $5,000. Most of the advantage you get is replacing a furnace if it's very inefficient with a modern-day furnace. And I will try not to mention any particular furnaces. I'm not in the furnace business. But, you know, the ones now can be over 90%. Some of the ones that we replaced, and I did look at houses that we made, were in the 40 and 50% because they were 40 or 50 years old. It was crazy. So that investment of $5,000 to do that, to do the caulking, to blow insulation into the home, you get about 28 to 30% energy savings. The next 10 to 15,000 you spend, you might get 2 or 3 more%. So that certainly is the sweet spot. That's where you're not going to go out and buy another house because of the energy you save. So I think that there's more work to be done on the rebound effect, but it is a real effect. So if we look at specifically breaking up these segments into what would we need to save from buildings and industry, transportation, renewable energy, and what would we have to get from nuclear and carbon capture and sequestration, the biggest challenge is certainly going to be here. And also in the U.S. and maybe globally, particularly since Fukushima is in the nuclear area. So let's continue to roll a little bit here. I thought I'd have a little bit of scenes from some of the work that we did do in terms of caulking. I think that I did a little analysis, at least in the U.S., and therefore, what do we need to do to get collective action? And this is something where I was so thrilled to be able to speak to a lot of the students here, because really when you think about, you're the most connected of any individuals, you know, in the history of the planet, right? So this is where we can really make a difference. Now, this is a little out of date. I always try to look online to get a better an LED up there instead of a CFL. But it turns out in the U.S., 4 years ago when I was Undersecretary of Energy, if every household in the U.S., is about 150 million households, would just change one frequently used light bulb from incandescent to CFL, we would have saved enough energy to power 3 million homes. And that would be the equivalent of something like, I don't know, I think I did the calculation, 30 million tons CO2. So that's 0.5%. That's not insignificant. In fact, I would argue that even 0.1%, if we can come up with ways of just saving 0.1%, those things definitely add up. So as a big proponent of energy efficient, in fact, to the point, and this is maybe being a little too revealing, but I would go to hotels, and I would pack a little bulb set. And if there were incandescents in the room, I'd just change them out. The most stunning was I went to Argonne National Labs to give a talk, and the hotel that was on campus had incandescents, and I was shocked. So I called them out during the talk. I know this is being recorded. Sorry, guys. But it was true. So I counted up the number of hotel rooms. There was about 140. There's 4 bulbs in a room, 600 bulbs. I did the calculation of how much it could save them per in the bottom line and also how much energy. And I sort of talked about that at the talk. And someone raised their hand and said, well, actually, we can't use CFLs because of the safety. And I was like, oh, that's not good. So anyway, let's just glad LEDs are coming along. But that is a significant use. Now, you know, everybody, in terms of again, depending on how you get your source for heat and air conditioning, that can be critical that we get off of oil-based in the Northeast, at least in the U.S., and that we look at ways, if we decarbonize the electric sector, then we need to heat instead of with fossil fuels, and we heat with electricity and air conditioning. This is one of my favorite ones. This is awesome. Of course, we know that a front-loading washing machine is more energy efficient, but, and again, I'm not going to name a product, but if you wash your clothes in cold water tide, we could save, at least in the U.S., with 150 million households in one load a week, 5% of our energy consumption, cold water. And frankly, I don't always wash my clothes as much as I used to. I did for today, of course, but nonetheless, this is one that's very important. This represents, you know, putting your laptop on asleep. It's almost two orders of magnitude how much energy you save, but more than that, if we unplug your appliances, you know, the vampire electricity in the U.S., that contributes, you know, I just have some notes here. I want to make sure I'm accurate when I say this. But if we could unplug all the appliances that aren't in use, we'd have enough to power 3 million more homes, too, which is another 30 million tons, which is another 0.5%. And then lastly, I have this car here, not just because of going to electric vehicles and or hybrids, but just taking one less trip of 10 miles a week. That's the equivalent of taking 10 million cars off the road. 10 million cars, the U.S., the average person spends 5.5 tons of CO2 in a year, right? So we drive about 11,000 miles on average per car unit. And that's significant. 10 million cars is a lot. Multiply by 5.5, that's almost 1% of our entire. That's just one less trip, round trip. So I don't have a car now. I'm on the metro or I walk a lot. And of course, I live in a big city, so that's quite easy. And I do, when I'm not in the city, I do rent cars, in interest, full disclosure. So just these few things here, if we could get a movement going, we could save, you know, 7 to 10% in the U.S. alone. Oh, the last one I should mention. This is stunning. Now, I don't know how many of us eat meat at least once a week. All right. So turns out in the U.S., I looked this up. I looked it up in several ways. Couldn't believe it. But the average person in the U.S. eats 3 hamburgers a week. Bless you. I know. I was surprised, too. So that's something like, you know, we have a house, I think, is it? It's either per person or per household. I think it might be household. No, I think it's per person. It's like 50 billion hamburgers a year. So just one less hamburger, according to my calculations. And they're close. Within, you know, any physicist here, definitely within a factor of two. So 30 million tons, again, another 0.5%. Just one hamburger, or one taco, or one barbecue, or those sorts of things. So there's an awful lot that we can do. The question is that, you know, will we? It turns out that in the U.S., about 87% of our rubbish can be recycled. About 40 to 50% of the people recycle now, which is great. Can we ever get beyond that, and what will it take? If anybody's got the answer, I'd be quite interested and see me afterwards. Okay, so big proponent in that. Let's talk about how would we decarbonize the electric sector. Well, I definitely put up hydro there. Certainly we need solar and wind, hydro, geothermal, even biomass. We have a big problem in the West with the pine beetle kill. So how we could decarbonize the electric sector is this path is essentially a third, a third, a third. Be a third renewables, a third nuclear, and a third fossil fuel base, which half being carbon capture and sequestration. Now, with regard to nuclear, we're already at 18 to 20%, so getting to a third is not that big of a lift. Well, that was certainly more true before Fukushima. We are building the first two nuclear power plants in the U.S. In the last 30 years, the Vogtle 1 and 2. And I think Watts Bar came online at TVA. So when I was undersecretary, we pushed and pushed and pushed to get small modular reactors funded, the licensing for it. These were things that could be built in factory so that they're much cheaper and then deployed on site, 300 megawatts and less, small modular reactor. So that's one opportunity. Renewables would have to become a third as well. The largest renewable in the U.S. is hydropower at roughly 9%, you know, 8 to 9% of the total electrical generation. And with the Recovery Act, I'll show you what we were able to do with wind. We took it from an installed capacity in 2010, on average about, you know, 5,000 megawatts. And by 2012, we were installing over 12,000 megawatts a year for a total of roughly 62,000 megawatts, either installed or in process. Just got the recent numbers about a month ago. So that is just extraordinary. And you see what happened is it was going on this path, and then it shot up with actually installed. So it took a while for the funding to make an impact, but there's no doubt what's happened with the trajectory here. And this comes back to policy. I did say something about, you know, engineers meeting policy. I thought that was sort of an interesting challenge when I became undersecretary. The policy change here was that we went from a 30% investment tax credit to a 30% cashback grant. So how many of you have ever tried to start a company? Right, well, when you do, or when you have, wouldn't it be great if someone gave you 30% of your costs back? I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was like, really, is this true? Oh, yeah. So that investment is the thing that drove wind. So you can see that the wind has increased dramatically, as has solar. Solar increased 208% over 2 years. It went from an installed base of less than 1,000 megawatts to now it's cruising close to 4,000. That's extraordinary. The reason why I mention this is that in order to achieve what we would need in renewable energy by 2035, to hit that 80% clean electricity by 2035, we would just have to continue on the trend of what we're doing now. We don't have to do anything more. So I think renewables are in a pretty good shape. When I compare it, though, to what hydro actually had a slight decrease. And the reason why is that there's, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about hydro later on, but about half of the hydropower in the U.S. is owned by the federal government. And the capital expenditures that we have in order to upkeep, modernize, and maintain these plants, the need is something like $4 billion over the next decade. And I think 2 years ago in the budget, Congress passed, there was $1 million in there for CapEx. So it's not going to happen that way. What I really think that the U.S. should do is either modernize or privatize those assets. They're 40,000 megawatts. It's not insignificant. It's a lot of. And estimate that if they were privatized and we could get capital invested to do the upgrades and modernization, we could put probably another 7,000 megawatts on the grid. No new dams, just modernizing and being efficient with what we have. And so that's one of the things that the reason our company is located in D.C. is I'd like to see that happen. I'd like to see private capital come in and invest in the infrastructure. So that's one of the little challenges. You also look at what's happened to the electrical usage over this time. You know, given that this was sort of a downturn in the economy, we actually decreased the electrical use by about 1.6%, which isn't insignificant. This is about another 0.5% in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Nuclear, I mentioned that a little bit. The large nuclear power plants that are the AP1000s or 1200s, they're expensive, about $6,000 per kW. So, and we, in the U.S., one of the things that Secretary Chu and I really pushed for is to triple the research budget for waste management. That is just something that we're actually trying to solve those problems in the field. And you have to do research to understand what's going on before you can devise a solution. And that was not the way they were being handled, particularly Hanford in the West. So that's something that we did triple the budget. It probably needed to be, you know, up by a factor of 10. Hopefully we'll be able to do that because we have to come up with a solution of what do we do with the waste at the back end of the fuel cycle. This is a plant that we actually took, a coal-fired plant, Mountaineer plant in West Virginia, and it was work with AEP, where we took a little slipstream, which is, at least from my understanding, I'm not a coal person, but, you know, it was just a little bit of the flu, if you will, of the emissions, and actually buried it about 8,000 feet below and did some tests where we were trying to do some carbon capture and sequestration tests. It was, unfortunately, pretty expensive, and after the money was invested and the plant built, and actually I went to the opening, it only ran maybe a year or so or two afterwards because of the expense. So without a policy that values carbon capture and sequestration, I think it'll be hard-pressed to see that kind of technology deployed. So that's one of the really big challenges. And then finally, just with our transmission and distribution line, if we can make this two-way, if we can make it so-called, you know, modern, some people may say smart, but even semi-smart I'd be happy with, you know, we could start to do things like you know, demand side management, where during the hot part of the afternoon, it was sort of in this 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. when you want to turn on air conditioning. This was done in August of 2007. You actually cycled down the refrigerator and use that energy to power the air conditioning, and you look at load balancing. We're able to reduce the amount of energy consumption by 20%, just being able to do the automated demand response in this particular pilot. So I think that that's one of the reasons why we had a big effort in terms of deploying, you know, smart meters. Was that the smartest thing to do? You know, I think it's what we knew to do at the time. We'll see in the future. Now, this is, I think, really interesting, and this is exciting in the following way, and that is if you can do peak shaving across any field, whether it's transportation, healthcare, electrical generation, it turns out that about 25% of the cost of distribution and more than 10% of the cost in investing in generation assets are there only for less than 5% of the time. And if you think about this, how do we get people to shift the load so that they do their laundry? You know, as again, I'm sort of advocating don't do your laundry that often, but if you have to do it, you know, do it off time. Do it in cold water. How do you enable people to be cognizant of that. And so I ran into, there's a really interesting professor at Stanford, Professor Balaji Prabhakar. I recommend you look up his work. So he's come up with these incentives, these micro-raffles. And so these micro-raffles, he went home, he sort of invented this. I mean, I'm sure he's not the only one who's thought of this, but he's actually deployed in a pilot. So he's from India, goes back to India, Bangalore, and he goes to visit some colleagues at Infosys. And they said, look, our biggest problem is we've got 17,000 employees. We send out buses to pick everybody up, and they come in. It takes 2 hours to get to work, 2 hours to get home. If we could just load shift the commuting time, we could give everybody an hour back of their time. And we would save almost $20,000 a day. So the company said, well, why don't we just tell the employees if they'll load shift, we'll pay them a buck a day. Well, because the reward was de minimis compared to the effort to do that sort of load shifting, they had less than 5% takers. So he came in and he said, well, you know, here might be a solution. Keep the expected value the same. So the average amount of money you give to 17,000 people is the same. Call it, you know, $10,000. But only give it to 3% of the people. So that now the rewards are hundreds of dollars. And if you do it right away, so they get immediate feedback and reward, I think we could do something here. So we ran a pilot. It was really interesting where they actually rewarded people with, if they got into work by a certain time, they would get a raffle ticket. And within a week, they would see money show up in their bank account. And about 3% was the magic number where the employees, this went out like through the grapevine. And within 3 months, 50% of the commuters changed their behavior so that they could participate in the raffle. And so, and I think on the other side, how many of you play golf by chance? Any golfers? Oh, a few in the back. Good. And over here. So have you ever looked at that car and that hole in one and you pay 20 bucks if you hit a hole in one, you win the car? I mean, I never do that. Unless it's for charity, then I do it, because I know I'm never going to hit the hole-in-one, right? So people give really big rewards for low-probability events. They don't really move the needle either. So he sort of discovered this, and then he applied it to Accenture, a consulting company in the U.S. on healthcare. That was a really interesting pilot. So what they did is they gave everybody a Fitbit, and I've joined the Fitbit revolution. I'm usually wearing it. I'm not actually today, although I'm walking around enough. I should have been. I'd have more steps. But so it turns out Accenture did the same thing. They said, if you walk 10,000 steps or more per day, we'll give you a reward. And they calculated the healthcare costs. If everybody walked 10,000 steps a day, how much more healthy they'd be and how much more efficient and how much money they'd save. So again, the same philosophy, same expected value, just give it to fewer participants but higher valued rewards and give it within a week or two. Within, again, 3 months, 50% of the employees of the corporation not only were participating with the Fitbit, but now they were starting to create these societal networks. So social networks might be networks of people you know, but societal networks, according to Balaji, are people you don't know, but they'd start to have their own competitions. And then if I couldn't walk that day, I'd hand it off to you, and you walk, and then we would share the reward if we won. And so it was really quite an interesting study. After the study was over, then the employees said, no, we want it to continue. And I'm not sure where that is right now because, you know, he was doing this as part of a research study. I think we could do the same thing in terms of energy and demand response. I just haven't quite figured it out yet. But if anybody has an idea, you know, let me know. But I think we could peak shave and save a lot of energy there. And then, of course, what I'm thinking about is light-duty vehicles, electrify them. But heavy-duty vehicles, look at either compressed natural gas or biofuels mix. So, and then this is the Green Hornet, pun intended, I guess, running on biofuels. Hopefully, if we can do some of this fuel switching, maybe we can avoid some of the disasters that have occurred offshore. And this was one that happened in late April of my second year in government. And that was really a very tough day. Andrew and I share a background in photonics, so you know maybe I can tell you this little story later. But this is an interesting story because the day this broke, a few days later, one of the big problems was the president couldn't come out and tell how much oil was spilling from that the blowout preventer valve. Couldn't tell. We just didn't know. So I was doing a mentoring event on the South Lawn with the president, with the science advisor, with some of the cabinet members. And you know, no matter how many times you met the president, I don't know, unless you've got ice in your veins, I'm still nervous, you know. So, you know, I walk up and I say, and I was thinking, what am I going to say to him, you know? And I just said, you know, Mr. President, we're really working hard on this BP oil spill. And he goes, thanks. And I realized that was the biggest Dodo thing to say. Of course, we're working hard, but you know, you could tell the pain that he just of the pressure, the environmental catastrophe, all those things. And so I went home that night. Andrew, you'll be glad to know, I had a postdoc. It wasn't the one that came in and studied yourself, but anyway. But he was an expert in particle image velocimetry. So when you think about it, you have this grit coming out with this oil. And if you did a double exposure experiment, it's essentially the Young two-slit experiment, capture it with a video camera, you can actually tell the velocity and the speed. I woke up at 3 in the morning. This, we published this paper in 1991. Maybe it was you. No, anyway. Anyway, we found the paper, John Sharp, pulled it off the web, sent it to the head of USGS, sent it to my boss. I said, look, I think this is how we can measure it. That's exactly the technique they used. And that was the first thing that Friday the president could finally announce that we knew, at least from the floor, it had to be at least this much that was coming out. So sometimes science, you know, certainly can come in handy on these things, but let me digress. We followed through on this. We published it, or sent it out for review. I don't know if it ever officially got published, but let me tell you what the punchline is here. And that is, if you would invest $1 trillion from 2010 to 2050, you could totally modernize the grid, electrify the electric sector, decarbonize the electric sector, electrify the light-duty vehicle fleet. You could do the freight switching, and you could implement demand response everywhere. You can meet your goal. It's $1 trillion. Now, I know that sounds like a lot, and it is, but let's break it down into smaller pieces. 40 years, that's only $25 billion a year, right? There's 50 weeks, roughly, in a year. So now you're talking about 150 million households. So I calculate that it's, and I really wanted to go get a cup of coffee here in Canada so I could talk about, you know, a Canadian coffee house. But it's essentially one skinny grande latte at Starbucks a week per household would fund this. And what you'd have at the end of it is not only all the benefits from a totally modernized infrastructure, but you'd have a residual value of about $600 billion in present-day value. So this is a good investment for the U.S. You would have all the health benefits, all the security benefits, all the job creation benefits, all those other benefits. This is exactly what we should do. Now, has the U.S. ever done something like this before? And we did. Over about a 25 to 30-year period of time, we built the interstate highway system in the U.S., and we put about 0.43% of our gross domestic product into that. This would only take 0.26%. So we have done something like this before. This wouldn't cost as much. But in our current climate, I'm not hopeful the Department of Energy or some other department or some other thing is going to get it. Now, the other thing is that the $1 trillion, if we look at the, you know, again, let's go to a startup, you know, you have to put in the $1 trillion so that, you know, you peak at the funding somewhere before 2030, you know, it looks like about 2025, and then you cross over to cash flow positive in about 2037. Well, that's a little bit of a long startup, and there is $1 trillion required. But you basically break even in the 2030s, and then it's all upside from there. So it's possible. Will we do it? I don't know. We could, though, continue to do business as usual. And this was an article published by David Green in Energy Policy, which basically said, what is the cost? And tried to do some calculation in terms of losses and potential loss to gross domestic product. You know, pretty much saying that we're going to have a tremendous amount of wealth transfer out of the country and loss in GDP if we continue on as business as usual. So let me just say a couple words about hydropower, and just I'll try and skip over this so we could get to maybe some questions should there be any. But this is sort of an analysis of the U.S. hydropower fleet. And as I said before, roughly, you know, if you look at it, almost 50%, maybe about 40-some percent is in the federal government and run and operated by the federal government, and the rest is private sector. So that's an interesting opportunity, I think. And this is one of the great... and I should step back and say, so what piece does hydropower have to play in the STEP plan? And so right now, I mentioned before, it's about 9%. We just want to keep it at 9%, maybe marginally increase it to 10%, which means by 2035, we'd have to add about 14,000 megawatt hours to the U.S. hydro fleet. We'd get half of that just by modernizing the government assets. We get the other half of that by powering the top 100 dams that are owned by the Army Corps. So there's something like 80,000 dams in the U.S., and only 3% produce electricity. So less than 3,000 dams, about 2,400 dams. So you could take down an awful lot of them. There are some dams that are going to be there for flood control and ponding. There are some dams that are there for navigation and recreation. Those probably won't come down. But we don't have to build any new dams. We could take down a lot of dams. In fact, an interesting thing was done in Maine where the Penobscot Agreement, if any of you are aware of it, where we actually took down a dam, enhanced a powerhouse that wasn't in the migratory path of the salmon, restored 1,000 miles of salmon run, and had more electricity generated. Those are the kinds of things that we should be doing now, very cross-disciplinary, engineers working with Nature Conservancy and some of the NGOs, American River Keepers, to take into account the environment as we try to preserve the environment through clean energy. So I think this is something interesting. Can we put 14,000 megawatts on through energy efficiency and upgrading and modernizing our assets? One of the ways we can actually increase the amount of hydro is by looking at pump storage opportunities here where you have a large reservoir and you pump up using wind or some other renewable solar during the day, I mean at night for wind, of course, and then because in a lot of locations it blows more at night, and then during the day when you need the electricity, you've got it there to replace other uses. That's one way of doing the peak shifting. These are just trying to go through some calculations. I'd be glad to provide this to anybody who's interested, but where you could actually get the improvements in the Army Corps assets, in the Bureau of Reclamation assets, in the current hydro fleet. So it's let me just move on. This is just kind of an overview of where the major hydropower plants are in the Army Corps and where they're located. As you can imagine, they're on the major rivers in the U.S. And again, just thinking if we focused in on the Army Corps with 20,000 megawatts, could we, what would it take to green the entire U.S. government? It would take about 14,000 megawatts. So if we could just upgrade and modernize what we have and power the top 100 dams, do some pump storage for peak shaving, we could actually do this. Never would build another dam. And these are just some of the sources. I'll provide you slides if anyone's particularly interested. So, when I got out of government, I decided that I really wanted to go after this one sector of hydropower. I wanted to carry out the plan. You know, you spend a year developing a plan, it's nice to do something for it. Wasn't going to do nuclear, you know, don't have any capability there, don't have the balance sheet to do it. Don't know anything about really fossil fuel generation. Solar and wind were well on their way due to some of the Recovery Act, so I figured I'd go back to my roots and really focus on hydro. So this is a dam on the Mahoney Creek in western Pennsylvania. We bought the permit from a developer, the FERC license, and then we went out and got all the permits from the Army Corps and the state. And this was built in 1941, and right here, it's kind of hard to see in the shadow, the Army Corps in 1941 had a lot of forward-looking vision, and they actually put a hole in the dam, a concrete plug, and they plugged it, hoping that somebody someday would come along, I guess 70 years later, and power it. So this is actually putting the draft tubes in place where you, from that hole right along the side of the creek, we put a 1,000-foot-long penstock, run it through turbines, generator coming out through the buried draft tubes back into the river. And these are just the spiral cases of where your water is going to come in and go down to the draft tubes, and then you just keep building it up with the runners, the turbines, and generators, and then the interconnect. This is actually the plug. I think it's about 10 feet in diameter. I think that's right. And then this is the valve vault, which is an extra butterfly valve was put in here as a potential extra stop if the roller gate would fail on the upside of the dam. This is the penstock, both start with P, and this is a 10 feet in diameter down alongside the river. So just continuing on, the interesting thing is that you'll notice here there's a ball valve and a jet valve here that the Army Corps operates. Right now they operate that by hand. So what we'd propose to do is to automate that. If we could automate that, then as the rain, we could actually move the pond level up and down and get more electricity depending on the rains, but still keep the amount of flow coming down the river so that you could automate managing the environmental positive attributes of that flow along with the electricity generation. So I'm just going to conclude by saying that we got it working we bought the permit in August of 2012. We got all the other permits, notice to proceed, and it started operating December 24th of 2013. Now, why December 24th is better than January 1st or 2nd, and that's because those incentives of that 30% cash back grant, the deadline was December 31 of 2013. So it got a little tricky there because the river froze the weekend before the Christmas holiday, and we had to get hovercraft out there in order to get break through the ice, get the dyers down to remove the plate in order so we could get water to the powerhouse. But it came online. It's rated at 6 megawatts. It's actually performing at about 6.6 megawatts, producing about 22,000 megawatts megawatt hours per year. It's the equivalent of having planted a million trees fully grown in the rainforest in terms of the carbon sinking from the atmosphere. So very happy about that. I just want to conclude by saying that I think the biggest challenge we have in energy going forward is collective action. It's also getting trained and skilled energy workers. The average age of the workforce when I was undersecretary 3 years ago, was 48. It hasn't gotten any younger, so I guess it's now 52. That's Boulder, Colorado. And I think that is also one of our biggest challenges. So I think that I'll end here. I'm a member of the African Wildlife Foundation because I think that the saddest part of all the climate change is, you know, our brethren who don't know what's happening to them and didn't cause it. And so this is a shot that I took when I was in Africa on a meeting there. And I think it's all our responsibility. So I hope we think to make a difference. So thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. And if we have time for questions or should anyone have a question, I'd be glad to try and address it. Thank you.
I had a very interesting interview, a depressing interview, I guess, a few weeks ago with Tim Berners-Lee and Jonathan Clark, who wrote a book called The Learning Question, which is subtitled Why We Can't Burn Half the Oil and Coal in the Ground. And their thesis was basically that whatever we do to replace oil and coal or carbon energy sources with renewables or non-carbon, it might be great sort of for our own economists, but in terms of climate change, it's going to have no effect whatsoever because it'll just shift that use for those carbon fuels off to other places where it'll make them cheaper, essentially. So they argue that without a carbon tax, that nothing we do is going to be affected, which is kind of depressing thesis, but I wonder what your opinion is.
That's pretty depressing. Yeah. It's my biggest concern as well. So one of the things with our company, we have a lot of opportunity to work internationally. There's a lot of hydropower opportunities in Africa, for example. I'll give you an example in Malawi. They have a hydropower plant, 20 megawatts. We'd like to upgrade and modernize it. They had another country come in and say, we'll build you a 1,000 megawatt coal-fired plant. Well, in a country where 95% of the people have no electricity, that's a pretty hard thing to walk away from. Now, the problem is that you have to, as you all know, there's the water-energy nexus. So if you build a 500,000 megawatt coal-fired plant, you're also probably running through, I shouldn't say a number because I didn't look this up before just to be sure, but millions of gallons of water. The question is that on a day or a year? And I think it might be a day-to-day basis. But so here's a country that doesn't have the water. So you're right. I really would like to get in and do the hydro upgrade there so they have the access. Plus, they have in the north part of the country the opportunity to do about 1,000 megawatts of hydro. So I think that, I would agree. The policy, I mean, I think that's the thing that I was going to mention on those curves when you see the wind and you see the solar going up. That's that amount of solar. If you look at how long it took us to get to 1,000 megawatts, and then you look in 2 years, we're up to almost 4,000 megawatts from one policy. And I think that's where we definitely need a cap on. I mean, a cap and trade for a tax on carbon. So.
Thanks. Questions
for me? Yeah, so that was, it's roughly $18 million. Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, what was the cost of the investment for it? So it was about $18 million. So that's about $3,000 per kW, roughly. Is that right? Yeah, 6 megawatts. Yeah. that's right, about 3,000, which would not make it that economic to build if we didn't have the state of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has a clean energy grant, alternative clean energy grant. So they actually provided funding of up to $4 million. So that nearly reduced the cost by $1,000 to KW. And since we qualified for the 30% cash back grant, that reduced it another roughly. So we're now down to around $1,500 per KW, which made it economic. And the reason that's important is because I don't have a balance sheet. I'm a startup. So I went to the bank, and I had to get a power purchase agreement with a strategic off-taker, and the value of clean energy, so that was helpful because energy prices, we kind of started at the worst possible time. Gas prices were under $2 a million BTU. I mean, I just want to say, why don't you just give it away for free and put me out of my misery? But it was a really hard time, but the bank believed in us. We got a good power purchase agreement. We were able to finish it on time and do what we said we'd do, so we were very fortunate. But yeah, it's tough.
Can you stand your part or withholding the people who would pay for you?
Yeah, and that's what we're doing. Right, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Thanks. Yes?
A question I have is simply, how do you sell nuclear power? 50 years ago, I worked on the Rajasthan nuclear power plant, and it took 200 megawatts. It cost $200 million, so it was $1 million a megawatt.
Wow.
And now it's 6 times that.
Right.
I guess the concrete prices are up or some stupid. Anyways.
In labor, I think
so
it was the straight labor.
I have to study nuclear power plants that I say in the top of Germans or California. Nobody's ever died in a nuclear power plant, a nuclear power. Yeah. Chernobyl was not a nuclear power plant, as you know. This old General Electric thing was built in 1965 in Fukushima, so it's an old plant.
Right.
And of course, it was a tsunami. Anyways, the politics of telling the public the facts is in all these misrepresentations. We had a nuclear power plant in Quebec here, and it came up as we were going to shut it down or not. And right away, Greenpeace and everything was on the airways for a whole week. Nobody else was responding to it. That
yeah.
Candy reactors are as safe as any other. So what? How do we sell? We had a turbine in Georgian Bay, a nuclear power plant there. It's also 200 megawatts. They want to send a turbine to France. They can't do it. Go by in my backyard to put it on a boat and bring it there. It's contaminated.
It's a great question you ask, and I think that I'll be honest. When I became undersecretary, I was not a big fan of nuclear. But when I did some of the work analysis, I learned a little bit about it, maybe enough to be dangerous. But as you said, it was Gen 2 reactors at Fukushima that didn't have passive cooling, very different than Gen 3 plus now. I think there's education. I think we didn't help ourselves in the U.S. by not doing any research on how we're going to manage the waste on the back end of the fuel cycle. I think that was a really unfortunate 40 or 50-year lack of our investment in the right thing to support it. So it's important to understand that no one technology is going to be able to do this in the kind of time that we need to act. And that's where I became a real big proponent of zero carbon based electricity, which I would include nuclear power in. So.
So can you elaborate a little bit on the benefits to the national security? What are the aspects that
right.
be benefits?
Right, exactly. So this has changed in the last couple of years because the U.S. now is in a different position in terms of export of oil and import of oil, right? But at the time when I was undersecretary, we were importing over 50% of our oil on an annual basis, right? So one of the president's goals was to reduce our oil consumption by the amount that we import from countries that we didn't think were, very friendly to Canada. So not Canada, not Mexico, but, and that was our goal. And I think that is a security issue if you don't have control. I think we're seeing that in Europe right now in a bit and how energy and power are related, not just power that keeps the lights on, but governmental powers as well. So I think that's the type of security I wasn't referring to. Much more the security that's been in the press sort of the last year, cyber, this is more physical infrastructure security.
Other
other questions?
Yeah.
I was curious about your perspective on carbon capture and storage. It seems like a big part of the portfolio.
Yeah, it is.
It's expensive, and it's a piece of the art for disposal that's a negative client perceptions and opinions. So I'm just curious how you think that could be globalized or
right.
What could be done.
Well, I think going back to the burning question, if you... A lot of companies, I would say, back in the mid-2000s, they had a carbon, they were studying carbon trading and they were getting prepared to go into a market because they thought that market was going to happen. So that, I think, what is it, when prices get above $25 per ton of the carbon, I'm trying to remember, carbon, carbon dioxide, I know there's a difference, so I'll have to do it. But anyway, when it gets above the metric of $25, then it becomes quite interesting, and you'll see the economics change a little bit, but without a carbon tax, that's why AEP closed that down, because they weren't getting any benefit from it, and it was expensive, so we need it. I think that's probably one of the big challenges of this whole process. What it means is that we'll have to get more from energy efficiency, conservation, and from the others if we can't utilize it.
So I have a question. So how do you convince people who don't believe in the reality of climate change that, you know, especially when the bottom line is dependent on business as usual? Like, for example, my industry is concrete, and at our conferences, climate change is like a laugh line,
yeah.
Right? And concrete industry is 5% global emissions.
Right.
So going forward, we're obviously going to need that. How do you convince people that they have to change despite not being their interest?
Well, again, I think that, you know, there's a carrot and there's a stick, right? So I think a carrot of being able to come up with some opportunity to either have to buy credits. I mean, one of the things that I dream about is what I'd love to do is have the ability for people. There's a company in the U.S. called Ethical Energy where you can actually buy electricity from them. And they're kind of a broker, I think. I'm not too sure about them, but, you know, maybe they'll call me after this talk and say, no, this is what we do. But anyway, so they'll come up. You can actually buy your electricity from them, and they'll source it. And if you had to buy credits, like say the concrete, you know, I mean, clearly we need cement, we need concrete. If they had to buy credits to offset the emissions, then I think that would provide the kind of funding so that we could do some of the other things that would balance it. So I think that, you know, that's, you know, obviously one thing. It made me think about... you know, something else. We would talk offline in an idea that.
Something that's prevalent in other countries, but like non-existent in North America, are power switches on electricity outlets.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how big of a chunk is like vampire electricity usage.
Yeah.
How much of a debt could you make? Obviously, it's a lot easier to flip a switch than to buy your own.
It's, you know, people say, you know, I've not done the experiment, you know, and I've not read the original paper, so with that as a caveat, which I highly recommend, especially in energy, but it's somewhere between 7 and 9% of the total consumption, which is not insignificant. So I never plug in because I don't have those switches on my outlets. I know my friends in the UK do. So I unplug everything. And if I stay at your home, I'm going to unplug everything. So don't invite me, because it's just really obnoxious when you put in your toast and you think it's plugged in and it's not. I get that complaint a lot of times. So, yeah. So here's what I think should be a really easy thing to invent. And here we have very, you know, creative people. So, you know, when you have kids, you plug in a little plastic thing in the socket so that they don't put their fingers in there, right? So why can't you come up with something that is a sense amp? That senses when you turn on, let's say, your coffee pot in the morning, you know, you're going to sense a change, which then just closes the switch that gives you access to the grid. And when you don't have it, when it doesn't sense that, it opens the circuit. I mean, it can't be that expensive. I'm probably naive the way that I've crafted it. I mean, the problem is real. You want something easy, it seems to me, you have it all the time plugged into the socket, so you don't have to think about it, right? Because people don't even like to unplug and plug in the plugs. So I've seen you'd sell a billion of those. I buy a lot. When I go to hotels, I plug them. Anyway, but it should be something easy for us to invent, I think.
Yeah. I started in this business in 2005 in Quebec. That was during that time, we went to Europe many times to look at biomass plants in all of Europe, all over the U.S. But coming back to Quebec was a disaster. because nobody wanted to build these kind of plants. When they did, we got all sorts of interference. So we put that momentum to Massachusetts. Mm. Massachusetts was just starting to get into biomass plants, and I found an employment right away. And I was involved in about 10, 12 plants right away. We even went to Mexico to put plants. But coming back here is still a disaster. Everybody wants to have his stay. They're all sitting around with suits and telling you, well, you have to do this and you have to do that. So that's the reason we left and went to Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, we managed to stay 4 years till I was starting to worry about my health. and it's so easy. You sit down with the environmental department, and they say, what can we do to help you? Here they give you a book, say, read this book. And this is what you have to do. So there's no business in bio-business here yet. There's no money to be made.
Yeah.
If there's no money to be made, you know, a lot of people don't want to be in.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that map, if it's the same one I'm referring to, is just the Army Corps, owned and operated. So if they're private, you know, Niagara, Mohawk, they wouldn't be on there. But yeah, I've looked at a bit at the opportunities in New York, and pretty interesting. Yeah.
Any last questions?
I just want to comment. Something simple that you talked about $1,000.
Yeah.
And in Europe, you step off an elevator, all the legs come back on.
I know.
Just a simple motion to make a switch.
Exactly.
And you get to see them in North America.
I know.
So, as you said, based on how.
Yes, exactly. Well, can I say one thing about that? The thing that drives me nuts is the escalators. Now, you in Europe, where I was in Turkey, you get on an escalator, you break a simple, you know, LED, you know, infrared, and boom, it's done. You know, it starts when you step on it, it stops when you get off. I did a calculation, but I don't remember the numbers, so I don't. But you can easily do a calculation of how many escalators that just run all the time in the U.S. It's crazy.
Well, quite a lot of the rooms in McGill and the Fitzroom have motion detector activated lighting. Yeah, so I think this room does. So we'll leave the
relationship. Okay, last question. What's the chance of Congress actually going ahead with your plan?
Well,
zero.
So I think it's starting. I'll tell you where there is a lot of good hope. You know, the states are really embracing this. The cities and the states are moving.
But that has to be Congress.
No, that's right. So the interesting thing is that you'll see states that are, such as Pennsylvania, doing the alternative, it's an evergreen fund, alternative clean energy, to promote it locally. And you'll see things happening locally. Obviously, California's been a leader. You see a lot of universities that are taking a lead. But I think that, I think future Congresses will act. And hope springs eternal. I hope they do.
So, with that, I'd like to thank Christine for
your
this wonderful talk.